Good evening. The Secretary of Defense is out. The virus spreads in New York as Joe Biden names his coronavirus task force and the trouble with the transition. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Monday, November 9th, 2020. Donald Trump says he's terminated Defense Secretary Mark Esper, using his final months in office to settle scores within his administration. In June, Esper had publicly opposed Trump's threat to use military force to suppress street protests over racial injustice after police killed George Floyd.
The option to use active duty forces in a law enforcement role should only be used as a matter of last resort and only in the most urgent and dire of situations. We are not in one of those situations now.
Defense Secretary Mark Esper. Trump on Twitter said Christopher Miller, director of the National Counterterrorism Center, will become acting Secretary of Defense. Esper's predecessor, Jim Mattis, quit in 2018 over policy differences with Trump. In June, after Trump had used various federal law enforcement agencies to clear peaceful protesters from in front of the White House, he was accompanied by Joint Chiefs Chair General Mark Milley. Afterwards, General Milley apologized for getting involved.
As many of you saw, the result of the photograph of me at Lafayette Square last week, that sparked a national debate about the role of the military in civil society. I should not have been there. My presence in that moment and in that environment created a perception of the military involved in domestic politics. As a commissioned, uniformed officer, it was a mistake that I have learned from, and I sincerely hope we all can learn from it. We who wear the cloth of our nation come from the people of our nation. And we must hold dear the principle of an apolitical military that is so deeply rooted in the very essence of our republic.
Joint Chiefs Chair General Mark Milley in June. The United Nations Human Rights Council, meanwhile, criticized the United States for its human rights record on Monday. Besides the usual critics of the United States, countries like Russia, China, Iran, and Venezuela, France and Britain also chimed in. Among the suggestions, that the United States provide equal access to health care during the COVID pandemic, root out racism and police violence, halt executions at the federal level, close Guantanamo Bay detention facility, and ensure access to sexual and reproductive health services. And in Africa, it remains unclear how many people have been killed in the fighting that erupted last week in the Horn of Africa between Ethiopia and the region of Tigray. Each side accuses the other of starting the fighting. The conflict in Tigray could destabilize other parts of Ethiopia, Africa's second most populous country with 110 million people, scores of ethnic groups, and other regions that have sought for more autonomy. In a sign the conflict might be spreading, Sudan's military has deployed more than 6,000 troops to the area bordering Ethiopia since the start of the fighting. And worldwide cases of COVID-19 near 51 million, with a quarter of a million deaths. The United States toll keeps rising as well. It's now one-fifth, or more than 10 million of those cases, and more than 238,000 dead. The news comes as President-elect Joe Biden pleaded for Americans to wear masks, declaring a mask is not a political statement. And he vowed to make defeating the pandemic his number one priority after replacing President Trump on January 20th. Trump has been openly at odds with his own coronavirus advisors, including about mask wearing. But they didn't stop Biden from naming Dr. Rick Bright, a former top vaccine official in the Trump administration, to head a 14-member coronavirus task force. Bright was ousted by Trump after he told lawmakers the government's failure to heed expert advice may have cost American lives. In New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo said today he's expecting the rate of positive tests for the novel coronavirus to continue rising into the winter. The governor also commented on news that Pfizer Pharmaceutical Company is developing a vaccine they say is 90% effective in stopping the virus. The Manhattan-based drug maker and a German partner are the first to reveal successful data from large late-stage studies of a COVID-19 vaccine. That's above the 50% effectiveness threshold the government requires and much better than the 29% effectiveness of the most recent flu vaccine. The good news sent Pfizer's stock price soaring, but New York Governor Andrew Cuomo says he has problems with any vaccine rolled out under the Trump administration.
can't let this vaccination plan go forward the way the Trump administration is designing it, because Biden can't undo it 2 months later. We'll be in the midst of it. I've been talking to governors across the nation about that. How can we shape the Trump administration vaccine plan to fix it or stop it before it does damage?
And that's Governor Andrew Cuomo. Meanwhile, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio says there are signs of an increase in cases in the city as well, but so far not a feared second wave of the illness.
Confirmed positivity level of 29.58%. So, look, right now that number remains at a fairly low level, but note that that positivity level for COVID continues to rise, and obviously with the number of cases growing, we are very concerned that there'll be more and more people going to the hospital. It's a level we can manage right now. Well, I'm thinking about the human reality. Anyone who goes into the hospital is dealing with a serious problem. We can't see that continue to rise, but right now, thank God, still at a lower level. But here's where the news gets much worse. Number two, the new reported cases on a seven-day average, that threshold of 550 cases for a long time, that seemed like a threshold we would never surpass. We then did surpass it in the last week or so, but now much higher, 779 cases. That right there shows you the magnitude of the problem. Some of that's explained by more and more testing, and more testing is good, but some of that is explained by the fact that the positivity levels are going up, and that is a problem. And that's what you'll see in number three, percentage of people testing citywide positive for COVID-19, threshold 5%. Today's report, 2.36%. Very worrisome. 7-day rolling average, 2.21%, highest we've seen in a long time. We can fight these back. There's still time to fight them back. But those are numbers that should have us all alarmed and ready to act with everything we got.
And that's Mayor de Blasio. New York City Health Department Commissioner David Chokshi says the outbreak is not connected to any one neighborhood, but is being detected throughout the city.
What we know from that evidence base, from the science, is that it happens anytime that people gather, but particularly when they gather without masks and indoors. And so that's true of social gatherings, as I mentioned. It's true anytime people are congregating for other reasons, whether related to work or more socially. And it's true particularly during the cooler months, because the air is drier and because people are more likely to gather indoors. So we do know the specific things that people can do to avoid the spread.
New York City Health Department Commissioner Dr. David Chokshi. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell threw his support behind President Trump's legal challenges in the wake of his loss to Joe Biden on Monday.
Our institutions are actually built for this. We have the system in place to consider concerns, and President Trump is 100% within his rights to look into allegations of irregularities and weigh his legal options.
McConnell didn't congratulate Biden, even as several members of the Senate Republican Conference have done so in recent days. His remarks came shortly after meeting with Attorney General William Barr on Monday afternoon. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer took to the floor moments later.
Former Vice President Joseph Robinette Biden will become the 46th president of the United States. Our dear colleague, the distinguished senator from California, Kamala Harris, will be the next vice president of the United States. And on January 20th, the country will finally turn the page on one of the most divisive and chaotic chapters in our history.
And that's Chuck Schumer. He's the Senate Minority Leader. Meanwhile, Senator Ben Sasse, Republican of Nebraska, congratulated Biden, calling him the next president. Sasse is among a small group of Republican senators that have issued statements congratulating the president-elect, even as Trump continues to allege widespread election fraud. An expert on voting rights is David Daley. He's senior fellow at FairVote. He says last Tuesday's election was a mixed bag.
We have seen a record turnout. You have seen Americans from coast to coast come out and cast ballots. You saw an election that was administered during a pandemic, and it went smoothly. So all plaudits to the election workers around the country who made that happen. And you saw Americans who braved a pandemic and new ways of voting by mail and voting early and figured it all out and turned out and were active and engaged. On the other hand, I think what we are also seeing are some of the defects of our system really laid bare. You are seeing that, once again, the popular vote risks being upended by a small number of votes in the Electoral College, whereas Donald Trump in 2016 is able to claim the White House with 80,000 votes in three states. This time around had 75,000 votes in Arizona, Georgia, and Pennsylvania gone a different way. You could have been looking at a president who lost the popular vote by many millions more than Donald Trump did back in 2016. You again are seeing the complications of the way that the Senate favors small states and rural states. Many, many more votes for Democratic candidates from these big states. And yet what you are likely to see is renewed Republican control of the Senate, despite, again, a minority of votes. And I think what you're seeing from many elected Republicans around the country has been troubling. It's been a real refusal to engage in the usual norms of conceding an election and coming together and moving on. You have someone who's supposed to be a non-partisan administrator at the GSA who's supposed to trigger a transition.
What's the GSA?
That is the General Services Administration. It is essentially the landlord of the government. They do the basic office supply stuff, and they've got to sign something and say Joe Biden is president-elect, and they're not doing that. You see the number of U.S. senators who have not yet come out and congratulated the president-elect that are continuing to act as if there is somehow something amiss about these results, and the results are clear and need to be accepted and respected if we don't want to do further damage to democracy.
It reminds me of my history courses in Catholic high school growing up, Julius Caesar coming to the river and crossing it and a republic becoming an empire. Are we looking at something like that in America?
As we approached this election, we saw that there was a real endemic problem with minority rule in this country, and it's become embedded in the structure of the Electoral College, to become embedded in the structure of the U.S. Senate. You have a majority of Supreme Court justices who have now been appointed by Republican presidents who won the White House despite losing the popular vote and were then put on the bench with the advising consent of a Republican Senate that won a minority of nationwide votes. And then you have state legislatures around the country, 50 million of us, living in states in which one or both chambers of those legislatures are controlled by the party that won fewer votes in the 2018 election. And I believe that's still the case after 2020. We need to do some really serious structural thinking about how we fix our democracy. We dodged a bullet this time in that this election was not as close as some people thought it would be. Imagine if some of these results in a handful of these swing states were even closer. We would really be talking about a constitutional chaos situation. So thankfully, it appears at this point that we have avoided that. But the flaws have been stripped bare.
What are we looking for and what should we be looking out for in the next part of this process?
That's a really good question. What you are going to see coming up, you've got a key runoff election in Georgia, two seats in Georgia for the U.S. Senate. That will determine which body controls the Senate, and that will really determine where our politics goes from here. If Democrats are able to control both branches of Congress as well as the White House, they might be able to do some work on the democracy reform and voting rights. Really, right now, it's all eyes on Georgia.
And that's David Daley, senior fellow at Fair Vote. Georgia has two senators who are both going to be facing runoff elections, four candidates, two seats, and that will decide control of the United States Senate. Meanwhile, a nonpartisan group of presidential transition experts is urging the General Services Administration, known as the GSA, to certify President-elect Joe Biden as the winner of the 2020 election and begin the presidential transition process. In a letter from the Center for Presidential Transition, a nonpartisan group that advises incoming administrations, several former top officials, including President George W. Bush's chief of staff, Josh Bolton, urged the Trump administration and Biden campaign to begin work on an orderly White House transition. President Trump has refused to concede defeat in the 2020 election and has vowed legal challenges in several states. 4 years ago, he had a very weak transition himself, the president, and many of his top jobs were left unfulfilled during most of his 4 years in office. The president and CEO of Partnership for Public Service, an organization that helps new administrations transition into the White House, is Max Steer.
It is about making sure that whoever is president is ready to govern on day one. It is a large, complex organization, our government. It has 4 million people when you count the military and the reserves. It has 100 plus different operating units. Presidents typically make 4,000 political appointments. I mean, it's a massive undertaking. And the only way that a president can be ready when they swear their oath on January 20th is if they've been an effective transition operation.
Where does a transition begin?
A transition begins with a recognition by a candidate that whether they win or not, they need to begin preparing for the possibility that they are going to win and to understand how to take over the government. We have a Center on Presidential Transmission at the partnership where we have literally a guidebook about how to do this. In order to be ready in time, you need to begin really in the springtime of election years. The Biden team has been at this from spring. They have a very experienced group of people who've been working on it. Ted Kaufman, a senator who has been very involved in transition legislation and understands these issues very well, has been in charge. They have a great team that's been working very hard. And they're not done yet. The period from election to inauguration is even more intense, and they need access to the agencies, they need their personnel process, and they need the financial resources to do this right, which is why the decision of the GSA, the General Services Administration, is so important.
What's going on with the GSA, and why is that a problem?
The GSA has actually been supporting the Biden team already. Legislation that actually Ted Kaufman was instrumental in getting passed requires that the government support transition planning right after the convention. So the Biden team has had support in terms of space and technology from GSA. But what happens after the election is that the administrator, the head of the General Services Administration, is supposed to decide on a winner. And if the GSA administrator makes that decision, then all these other resources become available to the transition team. In this instance, the administrator of GSA, Emily Murphy, has not yet made that decision. She is someone who has, again, been responsible for the help that the Biden team has already received. She is a serious person, so my hope is that she will decide real soon that the Biden team needs these resources for the team to be ready to go on day one. President Trump can continue forward with his legal challenges to the election results, but we need to make sure that the Biden team is ready to go, assuming that they, in fact, take charge on January 20th, because all of us get hurt otherwise.
What happens if she just doesn't? If she's a Trump appointee, she's loyal to Trump, and Trump decides that he is going to actively try and, which seems, you know, within the realm of possibility, actively try and obstruct it.
The Biden team can do a lot of work even without the cooperation, but there are some things that will be made much, much more difficult. It will hurt all of us because President Biden on January 20th needs to be able to deal with a horrendous set of problems. And in order to be ready, they need this help now. So delay is a problem. You ask what's going to happen. What will happen is eventually January 20th, our Constitution provides this. There will be a new president. And if the president has been hindered or in terms of his ability to be ready, they will do their best and we will suffer some consequence. So it's not a good thing, and it's not the outcome that I think any of us should want. Republican, Democrat, it doesn't matter. The key point here is that everyone should want whoever is president on January 20th to be ready to go, to fly the airplane that we're all in as safe a fashion as possible. And transition planning, smart transition planning, enables the pilot to fly that plane well.
President Trump came in, and he seemed to totally ignore the transition, and what effect did that have?
If you fall behind at the beginning, it's very hard to catch up. President Trump did not, in my view, understand how the government worked. He did not run an effective transition after the election. Pre-election with Chris Christie, he actually did a good job. And that meant he's gotten his people in place very slowly and made a lot more mistakes. It should matter to all of us.
And that's Max Steer. He's the president and CEO of Partnership for Public Service. One decision where most incoming presidents have found unity is the open secret of Israel's nuclear weapons arsenal. Each recent incoming administration has refused to acknowledge that Israel has nuclear weapons, which facilitates hundreds of billions of dollars going to the Middle Eastern nation despite prohibitions against funding nuclear weapons proliferators. Grant Smith is director of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy.
The primary purpose of the arsenal is deterrence, not allowing rivals in the region to think that they would be able to successfully overrun the country without any substantial consequences. The whole fact of the U.S.'s non-proliferation efforts and, again, the sort of non-acknowledgments of its existence cause a lot of complications, and there are also legal issues with USAID disbursements involved.
Even on official lists of nuclear states, you never see Israel.
No, you don't see Israel, and in fact, presidents, even President Obama, went to some lengths to issue policy directives inside the government saying, look, we're not going to be talking about this at all publicly. It's something the Israelis realize is an irritant. The U.S. can't really be a bona fide non-proliferation leader and speak with any authority because, as the Israelis have acknowledged and some of their leading thinkers have acknowledged, this is an irritant to the U.S. The United States and the Kennedy administration was opposed to Israel going nuclear. They've been opposed to efforts for Israel to, in one case, attempt to sell weapons to a friendly ally. And so this has just been something that's been ongoing.
What's the purpose of not talking about it or not recognizing it? They have it either way, and it's beyond being secret.
They've gotten to the point where the Israelis are approaching U.S. presidents the moment they enter office and asking them to sign a letter not to out the program. And the purpose, we believe, is because part of the Arms Export Control Act, two parts of it, the Symington and Glenn amendments, specifically forbid the United States to deliver foreign aid to any country that's trafficking in nuclear weapons technology outside the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency. So the reason to not acknowledge the arsenal, the reason to avoid all public comment about it, is that if a United States president admits that Israel is a nuclear power, he's got to notify Congress that he's going to break this section of the Arms Export Control Act and deliver standard aid to a nuclear power that's not abiding by IAEA. So it's got real policy consequences.
In Iran, there must be a feeling of, if they have it, why shouldn't we have it?
Right. And one of the reasons that some at the Begin-Sadat Center, a leading think tank back in the day, they speculated, you know, our rivals are going to attempt to put chemical weapons on long-range missiles. They're going to attempt to have their own nuclear weapons programs because of this deterrent. But Iran absolutely feels that way, and they also are under IAEA monitoring. So they feel the double sting of being constantly castigated for their program and also abiding by IAEA inspections, which Israel does not. Now, that doesn't keep members of Congress from threatening to withhold IAEA funding if Israel is denied its place as a participant in their programs, which is extremely ironic. So in one sense, we're bullying the IAEA and also letting Israel do what it wants in this arena.
What are the implications?
It helps touch off an arms race, and every taxpayer in the United States is going to be hearing a lot about maintaining Israel's qualitative nuclear edge. And they're going to be asked to meet tit for tat if there are arms sales to UAE, particularly advanced stealth fighters. They're going to be asked to pay for Israel to get stealth fighters. The big implication is that in none of these conversations is there going to be any true discussion of Israel's ultimate deterrent. And we think that it's long past time for that discussion to occur.
And what's your message to President Biden, President-elect Biden?
Why don't you come clean on this? And when a reporter asks you about it, answer that you know that they do have an arsenal and that the U.S. is going to take that into account when it's asking taxpayers and others around the world questions about nonproliferation and additional aid.
Do you expect he'll be different than these other presidents, including his old boss?
I suspect not. Barack Obama signed the letter just the same as Donald Trump and George W. Bush and Bill Clinton. So the odds are that he'll just continue rolling this log along.
Grant Smith is director of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy. And finally, Russian President Vladimir Putin won't congratulate President-elect Joe Biden until legal challenges to the U.S. election are resolved and the result is official. That's according to the Kremlin today. Putin is one of a handful of world leaders who have not commented on Biden's victory, which was called by major news organizations on Saturday. But President Donald Trump's team has promised legal action in the coming days and refused to concede his loss while alleging large-scale voter fraud, so far without proof. When Trump won in 2016, Putin was prompt in offering congratulations, but Trump's challenger in that election, Hillary Clinton, also conceded the day after the vote. Putin's spokesperson, Dmitry Peskov, told reporters Monday that this year is different. He said, obviously, you can see that certain legal procedures are coming, there are which announced by the incumbent president. Therefore, this situation is different, so we consider it correct to wait for the official announcement. And that's some of the news for Monday, November 9th, 2020. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, for the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.